From Toronto, Canada, this is 1 MHz, the Apple II podcast. In this episode, a pair of emulators gets improved, a replica gets revved, and there's a whole bag of new chips for old boards. Also, Apple's co-founder is now a co-author. I go on Safari, but I don't like it. The game least likely to need a review gets a review, and you find out how to get a song running through your head for 25 years. It's all coming up on 1 MHz for June 2006. Welcome to 1 MHz, 8-bit Apple news and 2-bit Apple reviews. I'm Carrington Vanston. Thanks for listening. It's been an eventful few weeks since the inaugural episode of this podcast, so let's get straight into the news. First of all, for those using Apple II emulators on more modern systems, a pair of the most popular ones have been updated recently. For Windows users, AppleWin was updated to version 1.13 and then shortly afterward to 1.13.1. The extra 0.1 on the end was to fix a crashing bug with Windows 98 and ME. Or is it pronounced me? I don't know, because Windows and me have had very little contact with each other over the years. For Mac users, the excellent Apple II emulator called Virtual 2 was updated to version 5.2. This update brings Z80 card emulation, or Z80 card emulation for my American listeners, to Intel-based Macs. It also includes an update to the included A2V2 program, which transfers original Apple II disks to the Mac so they can be used with Virtual 2. I'm a registered user of Virtual 2 myself, and I really dig it. I've been planning to include a more detailed review of this and other emulators in a later podcast, so if you've got one to suggest, or you'd like to share your experiences, good or bad, with Apple emulators, then drop me a line. Updates also came to hardware products this month, including the Replica One, an Apple One clone produced by Vince Brile. I'm assuming it's pronounced Brile. It might be Briel. B-R-I-E-L. Let's just call him Vince. So Vince will be updating the Replica One to have an ATX power connector instead of an AT power connector, and, this bit's really exciting, a USB port instead of a serial port, or perhaps in addition to a serial port, or maybe through an adapter. I'm not quite sure, but USB is a coming. The updated version isn't available yet at the time I'm recording this podcast, but it should come soon, so keep at least one eye on the Replica site. I'll have a link in the show notes on the Monsterfeet site, along with links to the other sites and software mentioned in this podcast. And, speaking of hardware updates, if you have an unenhanced Apple IIe, you'll want to know that a new IIe enhancement kit is available from GSE Reactive. The kit comes with a 65C02 CPU and the three necessary ROM chips, CD, EF, and the video ROM. The kit's available now for $25 US directly from GSE Reactive, which also now has 65816 CPUs available for both the 2GS and accelerator cards, as well as 64K DRAM chips to replace failed memory chips in the Apple II and Apple II Plus models. So it seems like it's run-don't-walk time over to GSE for people who are looking to either update or restore their Apple IIs. In other hardware news, the Ethernet card has sold out. If you don't know, the Ethernet card, or as I think the official name is, the Uther Apple II Ethernet module, was created by A2 Retro Systems, which is all one word with various capitals thrown in. But I forgive them the weird capitalization because the card is exactly what you think it is. Ethernet for the Apple II. I mean, how cool is that? I only recently found out about these things because I only recently came back to the world of 8-bit Apples, but if they do a third run, and I hope they will, then I am definitely getting one. And here's a bit of Apple II news that I found out through Dig, the user-driven social content news site that's so popular with the kids today. Apple II news on Dig. Don't tell me 8-bit Apples are dead and forgotten. Though, I guess, of course, if you're even remotely interested in listening to this podcast, then you're probably the very last person to actually try to tell me that, but whatever. The news was the release of something called the Apple Game Server. It's a Java program to send games directly to an Apple II computer through a serial connection, bypassing the need for floppies. Definitely something to check out. Remember that comment I made about the Ethernet card, the one that went something along the lines of, how cool is that? That pretty much applies here too. And finally in the news, there's a book a-comin' called I Was, From Computer Geek to Cult Icon, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It. As you can imagine from the title, which has two colons in it, but let's ignore that for now, it's written by Steve Wozniak, or rather co-written along with somebody named Gina Smith. The book sounds fun, although all I really know about it is the title. I'm sure it's going to be of interest to a lot of us early Apple fans, though. You won't find it yet on the shelf of your local big box bookshop, but it can be pre-ordered right now from Amazon.insertyourcountrystoplevel.domain here. There wasn't a release date listed, at least not that I could see, so I don't know when this thing's coming out. It could be that there's stacks of these books sitting on the publisher's loading dock, or I guess it could be that all Steve and Gina have is an interesting title and an excess of punctuation. I don't know. But maybe I'll have a review in the next show, and maybe it'll make the vaporware list of the 1 megahertz 10-year anniversary podcast. Time will tell, because that's what time does. Time is a big snitch. And speaking of time, that's all the time I have for news. Or, okay, to be honest, that's all the news I have at this time. So I guess instead I'll say, speaking of time, it's now time for the software review. Good save, Carrington. I'm going to review 2 pieces of Apple II software this month, the first of which is a game, and it's probably the very model of a game that does not require a review from me, or from anyone. It's probably one of the, if not the, most famous Apple II games of all. I would suspect that every single person interested enough to listen to this podcast has played this game, maybe played it multiple times. Probably you know more about this game than I do. Why am I reviewing it? Because it's an addictive little thing. I started playing it a couple weeks ago, and I keep meaning to try other Apple II software. I knew that I had these reviews coming up and that I should make an effort to try out a couple of new pieces of software, maybe something that's brand new, something that just came to the Apple II, or at least something that I had never played before, or at very least, maybe something a little obscure. But no, I picked this thing up, and every time I sat back down at my 2E, all I wanted to do was see if I could get a little farther in this. The game is Lode Runner, and it is, as I say, a very addictive little game. It's perfect. It's got perfect gameplay. Now, although I'm sure you all know the game very well, for completion's sake, I'm going to give a quick description of how the gameplay works. Maybe someday in the far-flung future, somebody will unearth my podcast in an archaeological dig, and they will wonder, what is this earth thing called Lode Runner? And I owe it to them to give an explanation. So this is not for you. This is for Spaceman Spiff in the future. In Lode Runner, you control a little stick figure character that runs and climbs in level after level of brick and ladder platforms. You can't jump, but you can fall from any height and not die. There are also sometimes railings that you can use to climb hand over hand. Now, Lode Runner is a non-violent game, which I find interesting and refreshing. You're chased by robots, although they look identical to your human character, aside from the fact that they wear red shirts. You can't kill the robots. You can, though, blast pits into the bricks on either side of you and cause the robots to fall into them, and then you can safely walk over the heads of the robots while they're in the pits. Eventually, your pits close up. Now, if a robot is still in a pit when it closes, then it respawns at the top of the screen. If you fall in the pit, then, well, you're dead, because you're good at falling, but you can't climb. The object of the game, though, is to grab all the caches of gold on the screen, although the gold is in the form of red and white barrels, but the instructions that come with the game tell me that it's gold. Once you grab all the gold on a level, then you need to reach the top of the screen and you can progress to the next level. Additional ladders sometimes appear once you've grabbed all the gold on a level, and sometimes the ladders are the only way to reach the top of the screen. Now, the robots are not smart enough to simply race to the top of these ladders and wait for you so they can inevitably catch you. Instead, they always fixate on your present location. Though, having said that, Loadrunner players always eventually discover that if you stand in certain places, like near the bottom of a ladder, you can cause the robots to run in a different pattern, which sometimes can get you out of a jam. Another technique that you'll always end up using, in fact you have to use on certain levels, is to dig multiple pits adjacent to each other to form one big pit. Then you can jump in that big pit and dig another layer down. For instance, if you dig five pits in a row, you can jump in. You'll now have room to dig four pits in a row, and you can progress down layer by layer. Sometimes that's the only way to reach gold that's been buried a few layers deep. This is as much a puzzle game as an arcade game, although some reflex work is certainly necessary. Success in Loadrunner, though, is found through strategy, and you can take all the time you want at the beginning of a level to study it before proceeding. It's a game that rewards thought and strategy and puzzle-solving technique, and I find it refreshing and engaging, and because of that, I think it's that element, the simple, easy-to-understand gameplay, the variety of levels, and the nice reward you get level after level as you solve these little puzzles. That's probably what has contributed to its longevity. I mean, this is a classic game. This is a game that has appeared on many, many different platforms, though it came first, in one sense, to the Apple II. So let's talk a bit now about the game's history. The game was created originally by Douglas E. Smith, who was a student at the University of Washington, and he created a prototype of a game, the game that eventually became Loadrunner. The prototype was called Kong, K-O-N-G, and it was on the VAX mainframes at the University of Washington. The game was an ASCII character-based game, and it was created in Fortran. According to a couple of sources I read, the game was exceptionally popular, and it was sort of openly hidden on the VAX system, where many, many, many people knew about it. The process was renamed to Graph, so it looked more like something that should be running in a university, I suppose. And there were supposedly times when, if you looked at the process loads, a very large percentage of the process load on the mainframe was Graph. And then that game got rewritten into a second prototype called Miner. That was written in 6502 assembler on an Apple II Plus, I think. According to most sources, it was an Apple II Plus. Others just say an Apple II. It's still done by Douglas E. Smith, and with help from others, though. He then sold Miner to Broderbund, and they stipulated that he had to come up with 150 levels. I guess he had proposed it would have 150 levels, and yes, indeedy, this game has 150 levels. That is a big bucket full of levels. Not all of them are amazing, but a large percentage of them are very, very good, and some are fantastic. So this is a game that gives you a lot of bang for the buck. Supposedly, Douglas Smith couldn't come up with 150 levels on his own. Now, I don't know whether that was just getting burned out and couldn't think of 150 level ideas, or maybe the time constraints. I don't know. But supposedly, he hired a bunch of neighborhood kids to use the level designer and come up with additional levels, and he paid them on a per-level basis. That, if it's true, probably explains why so many of the levels have initials in them, the bricks being in the form of initials and names. Maybe it's because so many people were involved in the level creation, and if a bunch of them were just neighborhood kids, they probably felt like tagging the game with their initials. So that does sort of make sense. Broderbund bought the game, as I said, and then it got released as Lode Runner in 1983. It was also released for Commodore 64, the MSX, and Atari, eventually on the NES. It spun off a number of different sequels. One thing that I found interesting, and I can't believe I never noticed this before. In fact, I only realized it when I read this as a fact on, I think, Wikipedia. I then went and looked at the games, and it seems to be true. But the characters, your little running men and the little running robot, are the same characters from another Broderbund title, Choplifter. They were, you know, quote-unquote, borrowed from Choplifter. The original games, the original prototypes, Miner and Kong, particularly Kong, used completely different graphics. Kong was, as I said, an ASCII game, and it used the paragraph mark, which is called a... Wait, think Carrington. A Pilcrow, that's it. So it's called a Pilcrow. That's the backwards P with the two legs. So that was the bad guys. Most people playing the game at the time thought that looked sort of like a cobra. Douglas E. Smith was going to, in the version called Miner, make the bad guys actual snakes, supposed to be slithering around. And I don't know whether it was changed because of time, or changed because it was easier, or changed because it was just a neat idea to grab them out of Choplifter, but somehow these became the characters from Choplifter. Now, the only other thing I can think to add to this review of Lode Runner is to tell you about the soundtrack to Lode Runner. This is a soundtrack that you probably can't hear, but I can't help but hear. See, as I said, the game came out in 1983. At the time, I had very little musical taste. Some would argue that I still don't. One of the albums that I was playing quite a bit was Call of the West by the group Wall of Voodoo. This was their breakout album from, I believe, 1982, and it had their big hit on it, Mexican Radio. Now, my record player at the time was one of the ones where I had a repeat button. I could stick on an album side, press the repeat button, and it would play that same side over and over again. That sets up one piece of the background. Another piece is contributed by getting this game Lode Runner. Now, at the time, I didn't have a legitimate copy of Lode Runner. I just had a hand-labeled, pirated floppy, as probably many people did. This time around, I actually purchased myself a used copy of Lode Runner. So I have an original disc and the instructions and a very, very flattened box. But back then, in 1983, when I first got this game, it was just me, the hand-labeled floppy, and my Apple IIe. I put the game on, and I guess just shortly before playing the game, I stuck on side one of Call of the West by Wall of Voodoo. And I hit the repeat button. That last action is one that maybe I shouldn't have done, because it stayed with me for the next 20 years. See, I played the game Lode Runner, and I got hooked really fast. So I sat there playing all night. This must have been a Friday, because I have this memory of playing multiple days, probably multiple days in a row. I would have stayed up all night long playing this game. The next day, you know, taking breaks for food, maybe for some naps, but I basically powered my way through all 150 levels of Lode Runner straight. And for most of that time, I left on Call of the West by Wall of Voodoo. From then on, for years, if I was just, say, driving in my car and on the radio came a Wall of Voodoo song, let's say Mexican Radio or Another Lost Weekend, I would get two or three notes into that song at most until suddenly I could see floating in front of me the latent images of some level of Lode Runner. That they were inextricably linked together. For 20 years now, if I have ever heard any song off that album, I can immediately visualize Lode Runner. In fact, I couldn't not visualize Lode Runner. So this time around, of course, I sit down, I start playing the game, I'm enjoying it, but something seems maybe a little missing. And then I realize, faintly, and perhaps a little psychotically, in the back of my head, I can hear the faint strains of side one of Call of the West by Wall of Voodoo. So I just... Well, basically, I just give in. I go get the CD, I stick it on repeat, and over the next 2 weeks, whenever I picked up Lode Runner to play a bit again, I stuck that CD back on, and I reinforced the pathways in my brain linking these things together. But even if you don't have the CD or the album at hand, this is one of the great games. The level design is interesting and unique and plentiful. The gameplay is original and well-paced and just hard enough to be challenging, but not so hard that any given level is going to make you have to play it and play it and play it. It rewards careful thinking and strategy. It rewards taking some chances. Certain levels force you to adapt your strategies. This is really just one of the all-time great games. But of course, you already knew that, didn't you? Now, the second piece of software I'm going to look at this month is not the most famous game of all time, or the least in need of a review of any piece of software in history, and that will make a nice change, won't it? So, this time around, it is an educational program for the Apple IIgs. It was released in 1990 by Orange Cherry Software, and it's called Jungle Safari. It's labeled as being for ages 4 and up, but I don't have a 4-year-old at hand. I do, however, have a 9-year-old nephew. He is a very typical boy in 2006, kind of hooked on his PlayStation 2, and a big fan of the Discovery Channel. So I thought, well, here's a good test for whether this game has held up. I recently got to babysit him, if you can still call it babysitting when he's 9. We went to the Science Center. We watched an IMAX movie. We played lots of games on his PlayStation 2. And I also took the opportunity to sit him down in front of the 2GS and have him try out Jungle Safari. He's a kid. He likes animals. This game is supposed to be for him. Let's see how it does. So, his first complaint was about the size of the screen. I ignored that because, well, it's a valid complaint. It's easy enough to hook up a larger monitor to the 2GS, and I probably should have done that ahead of time. So I'm not holding that against the software itself. To describe the software, it's fairly straightforward in that you are on a jungle safari. Not a hunt the animal safari, but basically a view the animal safari, and you can take some pictures of them. It's got some very nice color graphics. The top half of the screen is essentially a view of what you're seeing out the front of your Jeep. You don't actually see the Jeep, but you are driving around the land and you're viewing the different animals, sometimes in the waterfront, sometimes in the tall grass or in the jungle. The bottom half of the screen is your onboard computer, which strangely has the interface of an Amiga, but we'll let that one pass. And using an on-screen joystick, you drive yourself forward or backward through any one of 4 different locations that you can set out on. In each location, or at least in 3 of them, you can simply step forward, and in each location you end up with, there will be anywhere up to 5 different animals in view. You can click on any one of the animals using the joystick, and your onboard computer describes the animal. In one of the scenes, however, instead of just stepping forward from place to place and clicking on the animals to learn about them, you instead drive a little Jeep using radar so that you can track down animals that are marked on your radar, and when you find them, it's back to the same old deal again, where you select the animal and then you are presented with a couple of facts about it. And in this stage, though, you also get to hear the name of the species pronounced. So there was a bit of entertainment value to that. But overall, the only entertainment value this software brings to the table is the fact that it's on a computer screen instead of in book form. And early on, I suppose, that novelty factor would have been considered sufficient entertainment value. But for a kid today in 2006, it would seem, given the evidence of my nephew's response to the game, there is not nearly enough entertainment here to hold a child's interest sufficient that the educational aspects can be conveyed. And at the end of the day, I really don't think this is that great a piece of education. You learn one or two facts about each animal, but they're the most obvious, most broad fact. Perhaps there would be some educational value here to a very young child, say aged 3 or 4, who has an interest in animals but hasn't really learned anything about them yet. So there's a tiny market that might find it educational, but overall, I think there's not that much here to learn, and it takes quite a while for it to impart the little knowledge that it has to impart. So if we judge it on terms of its educational value, I really wouldn't give it that high a grade. I think as well that this is an example of the sort of software that I talked about in the first podcast, where time has simply marched on, that it hasn't weathered the years well. Its target market of these young kids now have, I would suspect, a lot of software offerings that are both much more educational and much more entertaining than this. I do not see this as, you know, the sort of software that would give you a reason to go buy an Apple IIgs. If you were sitting at home and had an interest in Apple IIs for some reason, but didn't actually own one, this wouldn't be a reason to go track one down. This wouldn't be enough to keep your young child entertained for more than 10 or 15 minutes. So unlike Lode Runner, for instance, which has lost none of its appeal over multiple decades, I can't think of anybody to whom I would today recommend Jungle Safari. So whether I judge it in terms of its entertainment value or its educational value, I gotta give Jungle Safari a failing grade for 2006. But of course, you might prove me wrong. It wouldn't be the first time. In fact, it wouldn't even be the first time today. To assist you in pointing out how wrong I am about this software, I have made available in the show notes disk images for Jungle Safari as well as for Lode Runner. Feel free to grab either or both and have a good time. Just watch out for the repeat button on your record player. And that brings us to the end of podcast number 2. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. Next month, I will have a bigger variety for you. I will have reviews of much more obscure software as well as reviews of things other than software. I'm quite looking forward to that. I'll see you next month. You've been listening to 1 MHz, the Apple II podcast. Feedback and suggestions can be sent by email to feedback@monsterfeet.com. All the files and links mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes in the 1 MHz section of the monsterfeet.com website. And like all Monsterfeet podcasts, all the original material in this episode is released to the public domain.